your hands, everybody, if you got what it takes. Because I'm Curtis Blow, and I want you to know that these are the Breaks.
Hello, this is Jonathan Paley of the Paley Brothers, and you're listening to 90.7 FM, WGXC, ACRA.
On October 28th, two incredible performers come to the Hudson Valley. Meg Baird and Chris Forsyth are both performing at Tubby's in Kingston. And they're both playing with the same band, Douglas McCombs from Tortoise and 11th Dream Day on bass, Ryan Jewell, who plays with Riley Walker and many others on drums, and Charlie Soffley from Heron Oblivion on guitar will be backing both Meg Baird from Espers and Chris Forsyth. Performance is October 28th from 8 to 11 p.m. at Tubby's in Kingston. You can find out more about this show and many others on the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Sun Common, supporting vibrant communities across New York for over 15 years, offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Roundtop Productions in Roundtop, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. Thank you for your support.
Give me liberty! Or give me death!
WGXC, the station that gives you liberty.
Good evening. Thank you for joining. I am Kimberly Wirewin, your host of Race Talks on WGXC 90.7 FM, awayfarm.org enterprise. Here every third Tuesday of the month from just around 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. is where we have the very necessary conversation on race and ethnicity. Oftentimes I'm asked, why talk about race? My answer is to combat racism. But we can't just talk about it. Although education is key and discussion a must, we all need to take an active role in ending racial injustice here in America and abroad, because there's simply just one race, the human one, and many ethnicities. And here on Race Talks is where we keep it real and
no topic is taboo.
And you're hearing from my wonderful guest on air live, Mr. Gregory Owens, who I had the fortune to meet this year at a training sponsored by the Columbia County Organization Co-Host that took place at the Hudson Area Library. And I'm sure he'll give you insight into more of how we met, because that's one of the things that he does. And I'm going to get into everything he does, and it's a lot. I think we have just enough time to get in his whole history and background. Also, tonight's September Talk episode is going to include highlights from my interview with the one and only Leah Penniman of Soul Fire Farm. And I mentioned that last month when we had the part one of our two-part series in race and wellness. And so this topic is racial healing. So we're going to look at a Q&A, DYK, which is do you knows. We're going to look at some code words. We're going to look at talk terms. And of course, this month, part of this month and the first part of next month, October, is Heritage Month celebration, which is the Hispanic and Latino Historic Heritage Month. So we're going to be celebrating that today, also by providing a musical extravaganza with Celia Cruz, who is a Cuban-American phenom in music. So that's going to be the last 3 minutes or so of our talk. So once we sign off, don't leave that dial, because you're definitely going to miss out on some really great music. And there's going to be a little bit of music in between. I've taken the onus to try to include Leah's and I's interview in between the conversation that I'll be having today with Gregory Owens. So let's just get started Oh, I just want to mention too, next month, we're also going to have a Latina on our show, Maylene Colindres, who is an educator, has an inspiring story about how she found herself in America at the age of 15 and how she thrived right thereafter. And she's an educator now, and she is so very excited about being on this show to share with our audience and listeners out there about how they too can be successful just by putting in the effort and really feeling secure and confident in who they are ethnically and their heritage, being strong about their heritage. So I think I want to start this conversation by introducing Leia, and she's going to share a little bit about herself too. So my first guest is Sol. I'll call her a special guest, and she's not present, but it's going to seem like as if she is. Leia Penniman is a co-owner of Soulfire Farm, and their mission is to be an Afro-Indigenous-centered community farm that's committed to uprooting racism and seeding sovereignty in the food system. You'll hear co-founder Leia in our taped conversation sharing how their organization both raises and distributes food that is nutritious to help communities that are not able to obtain healthy and wholesome food. And what I like most on their site is this particular statement. It reads, "We work to reclaim our collective right to belong to the earth and to have agency in the food system." And the mission continues with, "We bring diverse communities together on this healing land to share skills on sustainable agriculture, natural building, spiritual activism, health, and environmental justice. We are training the next generation of activist farmers and strengthening the movements for food sovereignty and community self-determination." And like I mentioned, we have segments, and one of our segments is to look at food as medicine. So I'm going to introduce Leia right now. We can put that sound on live. It's coming. All right, here's Leia. Welcome, Leia Penniman. And can you share a little bit about yourself with the Race Talks listeners?
Absolutely. And thank you so much for having me and for your patience. We are finishing up our last farming immersion program of the season, where we train rising generation Black and Brown farmers. And my name is Leia Penniman. I'm one of the co-founders and also the farm director here at Soulfire Farm in Mohican Territory, Grafton, New York. And we and I have dedicated our lives to uprooting racism and seeding sovereignty in the food system. So we grow a lot of food and medicine. We deliver it right to the doorsteps of people who need it most in the community. And we also work to educate and defend and advocate for Black and Brown farmers and others who care for the earth, so that we can all have, you know, access to land and businesses and a voice in the food system. So super excited to be here talking with all of you about this very important conversation on the intersection of race and our well-being.
Okay, so that's how she introduces herself. And we talked again about terms. So the first term is about how we call ourselves, so our identity. And I know that my guest live has a lot to talk about identity. So I'm going to bring him on and share with all of you who he is. No? Yeah? Okay. All right. We're looking at each other, making sure we're on the right page here. So I'm just going to read, I would say a little bit, but this particular guest has so much to offer by way of his history that I want to take the liberty to read more about who he is. So I hope that you have your listening caps on, because he's quite a coup to get on my show. Gregory Owens is the person on my show who is a licensed master social worker who retired from New York State government employment after 34 years. He worked for the Office of Children and Family Services in various management positions. As a director of strategic partnerships, he led statewide initiatives in the areas of fatherhood development, mentoring, and disproportionate representation of children of color in the juvenile justice and child welfare systems. For 2.5 years, he served as the deputy commissioner at the Division of Criminal Justice Services, where he led the Office of Youth Development. Knowing this part of his background, you know why I am psyched he's on the show, but why I know he will have a very informative conversation is because of our connection to the subject of race and ethnicity. Mr. Owens has collaborated with schools and school districts, facilitating sessions with administrators on implicit bias, leadership, cultural competence, and mastering difficult conversations, and with the Albany Law School on diversity and inclusion efforts, facilitating listening sessions with faculty, professors, and students. From 2018 through 2020, he convened leadership development retreats for the university at Albany University Center for Academic and Workforce Development, which I might add, makes me feel I needed to have him on the show for our next month's introduction theme, which is race and the workplace. But we have him here now. And for race and wellness, because yes, there's more. Gregory's work in health disparities includes convening the Albany Minority Health Task Force for the University at Albany Center for the Elimination of Minority Health Disparities and consultation with the Adirondack Health Initiative, presenting workshops on health literacy and culture to stakeholders in the upstate region of New York State. He was appointed to the New York State Board of Regents work group to improve outcomes for boys and males of color in 2015. He has participated as a member of the Campaign for Black Male Achievement, the National Advisory Board on Improving Outcomes for African-American Males in the Child Welfare System, Identifying Effective Programs and Services, and the Alliance Network of Social Service Administrators Committed to Racial Equity, and was an advisory board member of the Child Welfare Adoption Leadership Institute, developing and supporting emerging leaders of color. And I don't know if I'm emerging, but he certainly has supported me. And I want to now give the floor to Mr. Gregory Owens. Please share with the listeners anything more that I may have mentioned, I may not have mentioned, adding, of course, why the topic of racial healing is so valuable to you.
Thanks so much, Kimberly. And certainly you're more than an emerging leader. I think you're already engaged in great leadership work, and so I appreciate the opportunity to spend time with you and be a part of this evening. I guess the only other things that I would add, you know, that I am married 29 years to my beautiful wife. We have a 26-year-old daughter who is pursuing her doctorate down in Virginia, and I am a proud deacon of the Macedonia Baptist Church in Albany, New York, and I guess that's the thumbnail sketch of the rest of who I am. So this conversation is really critically important because I think racial healing is something that we don't spend a lot of time talking about. I think we underestimate the harm that has been and is being done to BIPOC people, and particularly specifically as we talk about African-American and people from the African diaspora who continue to be harmed by public policy, by agency policy and institutional policy, organizational practices, as well as the narrative that is permeating our society that is resulting in individual acts of terrorism against people of color and communities of color. And that happens both, you know, physically, psychologically, spiritually, in any domain you might want to think of. And so the attacks we see against people of color from Buffalo to other parts of the country are part of a narrative that encourages that, that's part of historical reality for people of color, and particularly people of African ancestry, as we try and navigate through this society that really has never fully accepted us as completely human and as full citizens. So how do we engage in a process where we can get to the best of ourselves, be our complete full selves, speaking to the issue of identity, and how do we get to a point where we can help other people and even other systems heal? And so this notion of healing is critically important to our becoming well and to our seeking to make other people and communities well.
I really love that you mentioned the fact that, you know, it's not just African Americans, but people of color in general. And one of the negations that we have that puts us in the bottom realm of ethnicity groups in America is because we do lack a lot of our knowledge from our history, our heritage, and not having that in our having knowledge on that really destroys a lot of our ability to teach and transform our young people. And Leia speaks to some of that with the term that I asked you to talk about. So I want to add the term what BIPOC is. And you mentioned also BIPOC, and she and her organization, they use the term African indigenous. So I asked her about that. So I'd like for us to listen to what she says, and then maybe you can share your understanding of those terms too and how they help you in your work. Okay, we'll talk on the other end. Well, you mentioned, of course, the farm. And one of the segments that I like to talk about is terms. The farm is Soul Fire Farm. Can you give us, and as a co-founder, can you give us any background on why this term, Soul Fire Farm?
Oh, I love this question. So I'll tell you two quick stories. One is a personal story. So my spouse, Joan, and I were living in the south end of Albany. We had a newborn and a two-year-old. And for anyone who knows the south end, it is a food apartheid neighborhood. The government would call it food desert, but we don't think it's natural, so we don't call it a desert. And there were no supermarkets. There's no farmer's market. There was no available land to farm, and not even a bus going to the supermarket. So it was very difficult to get fresh, nourishing, ancestral, healthy foods for our family and for our neighbors as well. They were having similar struggles. So when they found out that we knew how to farm, they started teasing us about, when are you going to start a farm for the people? And we'd always had kind of a distant dream of that, but that lit a fire under us to go ahead and wed ourselves to this land and start Soulfire Farm. Our very first program that we did was to grow food and deliver it to the doorsteps of our neighbors in the South End. So, you know, fire refers to the passion, soul refers to the sacred imperative to do the work, but the name itself actually came from a reggae song. So we were listening to some reggae music, and Lee Scratch Perry has a wonderful song called Soulfire, and we ain't got no water. Is how it goes. So when we were listening to that song, we said, oh, that'd be a perfect name, because that's what we're about. We're about the passion and we're about the sacred commitment.
I think I might have that song available, but I'm going to probably play that later and let her talk about the term that I mentioned, because that's also a great hit that could be noted. Can you share a little bit about how you've gone from making this commitment to having a farm to feed yourselves and some members of the community to really making a full-fledged enterprise where it's about equity and justice?
Oh, such an important question. Yes, absolutely. There's a African-American saying, each one teach one. So we are an educational institution. We work with, you know, over 100,000 learners every year, both in person and virtual. People come from, you know, 30 plus states around the country, some international, to join our programs on the farm. And, you know, this builds on a long legacy. So if you go way, 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 way back, right, our ancestral grandmothers had the audacious courage to braid seeds into their hair before being forced onto transatlantic slave ships. That was their insurance. They believed against odds in a future of tending the soil. And they believed that we, their descendants, would exist to inherit the seed. And despite, you know, chattel slavery and sharecropping and land dispossession and, you know, white supremacist expulsion from land and government discrimination and on, all these assaults on Black people's relationship to land, that seed has been passed down, both literally and metaphorically, has been passed down. And so it's been very important to us to think about how do we be part of that legacy. You know, when folks think of organic or regenerative farming, it can be very whitewashed and people think that our folks didn't have anything to do with it. But Dr. George Washington Carver out of Tuskegee University in Alabama in the late 1800s was, you know, the godfather of the modern organic movement. You go even further back in the Ovambo people of Namibia were the ones who came up with the kind of raised beds that we use, and women of Ghana and Liberia created the kind of composting systems that we do. So many examples, which I write a lot about in Farming While Black, which is, you know, we'll talk about more later. But all that to say, it was important to us to have educational programs that uplifted the noble and dignified contributions of Black agriculturalists to the food system, and also to create a space of cultural relevancy, of joy, of community. And the programs came from the community themselves asking us, you know, it's like the people were eating our food and they said, well, can we come out and learn? I want to learn to farm. Can my children come out? And so bit by bit, you know, we built more programs. Our most popular is a week-long intensive 50-hour course that's residential where people come on the farm, but we also have an 18-month fellowship. We have day-long youth programs and so on. And we're teaching the very practical, like soil chemistry and business planning, as well as this history and cultural context for what it is to be in relationship with land.
Well, thank you. I think that there are going to be listeners who want to take part in that. So like you said,
yay.
You wanted to hold off on Farming While Black, but share more about Farming While Black. It's a workbook. So it's not just a book where you read it for information, but you can actually use it to activate. Maybe I think I may have given this audio out of order, but I want to back up and talk about our book a little bit later, like she mentioned, and concentrate now on the terminology she was using, where she was talking about the injustice, pretty much, and how, like I mentioned, that we lost our culture, and she brought the understanding of Black people coming from the farms, coming from Africa in itself. And that's what she teaches on the farm. And you bring in this kind of awareness in your training also, where we have biases based on what we think is relevant in our own cultural norms and makeup. So anything you would like to add to what you bring to the table in training, what's important to heal the racial divide?
Yeah, thanks, Kim. I think that what Leah said is just so profound in lots of different ways. And so I'm probably gonna bounce off of a couple of her ideas, because they do kind of integrate nicely into this notion of how bias impacts us, how knowledge is important, and the importance of looking at ways to heal as a normal way of walking through the world. And so when you begin to talk about the lack of our understanding of our history, the full understanding of our history, right, which is not accidental, because we have, you know, an educational system that was set up to keep us from learning, you know, about our greatness, about, you know, our connection to the land of Africa, to the continent, and not what we were taught growing up, which is, you know, that it was a country, at least during the time when I was growing up. You didn't get a concept of scope and scale, right? So you didn't get a concept of the fact that, you know, Africa was around long before many other nations in this world were around. So I think that it's important to have an understanding of your history, so that you can understand that you have a foundation, and once you know, you can't unknow. And so the acquisition of knowledge and truth is a part of this prospect of healing. And so there are two places, two sources that really add to our frame, our view of the world, right? And we talked about this in the session that where I met you in Hudson. And we talked about this notion of where biases come from. And they actually come largely from media, all sources of media. And it comes from family and kind of first level friends who are very influential, whose perspective we appreciate and respect, and yet it may be lacking in accuracy and fullness and completeness and truth, right? And so even when you're spending time together with family and you have elders and you're listening to them, they are giving you often their perspective and what they were taught growing up, either by family members or by systems that still did not have complete, accurate, truthful information. So you can't really be liberated. You can't really heal when you're operating based upon false premises and inaccurate information, right? So I think that this notion of really getting an understanding, you know, in terms of what she's doing around food and agriculture and growing food and connecting with the land is critically important. Otherwise, you miss the fact that there would be no United States of America were it not for the skills and competencies of the African people who helped to plant and till the soil and plant and grow things that kept this nation alive and gave it its economy. And so when you talk about this whole notion of making history real and even bleeding it into the conversation of what reparations really means acknowledging that and then beginning to figure out how to apologize for, you know, the atrocities that were associated with that and then figuring out how to get to a place where you can help people heal. And so lots of people think it's just about the finances. No, it's really about recentering the truth and then pursuing fairness and justice and equity based upon that. So I like a lot of what Leah said based on that. I just want to note that once upon a time, our church had a bit of property, a bit of land out in Wellington Farms in Schoharie County, a Black-run farm entity and business by a couple who left their you know place in government and private industry to go out there and buy this beautiful multi-acre property. And they were gracious enough to give us the land and help us figure out how to plant foods and then bring them back to the church and the community so that we could give them away. So that's my first experience with learning how to kind of till the soil, plant seeds, and go back out there and weed and make sure they were. And it was hard work, but it connected you to something that historically we have always been connected to. And that was, how do you get into this notion of rebirth and birth and growth and taking care of yourself? Because you can plant and you can grow. So I really like what Leah was talking about. And I just wanted to lift up that we did that for many, many years through our church community.
Well, that is so wonderful. And I think we've gotten so far away from that. I mentioned in the interview, and I'm not going to say everything because I want to actually allow you to hear it. But I mentioned the fact that, you know, we think of food as coming in a box or plastic or a can and not really on land. And that because of slavery and being on the land, it kind of makes one believe that if you do work on the land, then you're going backwards as opposed to healing and going forward. But like what Leah said and what you mentioned by having the food and being able to give it, it's something that's so natural to a person that being taken away from the land, it's unnatural now. And so part of that healing process is going back to what is natural. Mm. Some people think of it as natural hair, but it's just, you know, being wholesome more in, you know, how we heal our bodies, heal our soul, heal our minds. And you mentioned reparations. I always say reparations is to repair relations. And like you said, it doesn't have to be financial, although, you know, it's people look at the history of Black Wall Street, how the financial wealth of the Black community was devastated and destroyed overtly and on purpose. And that's part of what you share when we're talking about systemic racism, mm-hmm. that it's in the financial systems, it's in the social systems, the mm-hmm. safety nets. Why people, you work with young Black males, why are young Black males imprisoned more frequently than people who may do the same crimes, but then don't get the same time? So mm-hmm. that's all kind of connected.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm not even going to say what the next conversation is with Leah and I, because so far I'm out of order, but I like the fact that you can find meaning and share a lot of what you would like to share through her conversation too, which is why I wanted to kind of weave it in to ours. Mm-hmm. So if you don't mind, I'm going to play a little bit more and have a little bit more of a conversation on talk terms. But I did want to bring up, did you know? There's one thing that I found on the website that was very interesting, and it comes up with the Heritage Month that we are celebrating. And it's the fact that when we talk about land, who's working the land in America right now? So did you know, I'm going to find the did you know section here, yes, that 85% of the people working the land in the United States are Latinx migrant workers, yet only 2.5% of farms are owned and operated by Latinx. People of color are disproportionately likely to live under what we call food apartheid and suffer from diabetes, heart disease, and other diet-related illnesses. And coming from the fact that sometimes you can't be healthy and forward-thinking and professionally oriented if you're not healthy physically. So I think that's something that we should definitely look at. And I'm going to add, you're shaking your head. You want to say something now?
Well, I think it certainly resonated for me because all of the physical illnesses that you just mentioned, you know, are in part manifested by kind of individual factors. And yet they come out of a structural situation, structural racism, where we are under such persistent stress as a people from all of the various toxins we walk through in relationship to the various institutions that we have to encounter, right? So we're under constant, what Dr. Sean Jenright from the Flourish Agenda, who you know, group certified me in healing-centered engagement, calls social toxins and persistent traumatic stress environment and experiences. So there's nothing post-traumatic about our existence. And what that does to us in terms of the chemical imbalances in our body, what it does to us in terms of our ability to cognitively process information, because it plays with our ability to be situated normally in a physical realm. So stress is adding to the other kinds of factors that contribute to our bad health. And so what you can do to people is not just help them to lead healthy lifestyles and walk more and eat better if you're going to kill them through stress,
yes.
Right? And so you can look at me and say, well, individually, you got to do all these things, right? That's kind of a resilience mindset. But if you don't take your foot off my neck and stop the stress that is causing me to have a shortened lifespan, it doesn't matter how far I walk and how much I could form to a diet, that will still lessen my full opportunities for full life chances. And so it's important to understand the structural nature of this, because food scarcity is not an accident. It's part of a structured approach to dealing with people in terms of where you place them from the perspective of housing, right? Opportunities, you know, that are confounded by redlining and banking and real estate kinds of discriminatory practices that all fit within this racist, structural racist kind of perspective. So I just wanted to lift that up as we move forward.
And that is the truth. So let's hear some more of Leah's and I discussion. And we do like, in this conversation, we also look into, like I said, terms. And so I want you to hear some of the terms, and I want your perspective on how, you know, is labeling people stressful too? So, because you mentioned stress, so let's listen to what, you know, we talked about, and I'd like your take on it, Mr. Owen. Even sure. Going so far as to create in your own community, maybe you live in a city or something like that, to make sure that your area isn't food deprived, correct?
Yeah, I love the way you frame it as a workbook. Okay, so Toni Morrison, an ancestor in blessed memory, said, if there is a book that you need to read that hasn't been written, go and write it. So Farming While Black was a book that I needed to read. I started farming when I was 16. I fell in love with the elegant simplicity of putting a seed in the ground, growing some food, and feeding someone who was hungry. There was undeniable goodness to that. And being a teenager is confusing. So confusing. And to have something that made sense was an anchor for me. But as I got more into farming, because I didn't stop, you know, I'd go to these conferences and It was like, to be honest, it was all white men who were presented as the experts, as the authors. And I got not only discouraged, really disillusioned. I thought, well, am I being a traitor to my people? You know, I could be putting my efforts into things that are important in my community. And maybe I'm, you know, dabbling in someone else's issues. And, you know, fortunately, I had a wonderful mentor, Karen Washington, who's a Black farmer south of here, who helped me through that. But all that to say, you know, I needed to be able to see people who look like me, who had my life experiences. And I needed to understand that our history on land wasn't just slavery. So Farming While Black is that. It is absolutely a workbook. It tells you, you know, how far apart to plant your carrot seeds and how to incorporate your LLC and like all those things that you need to get your business going and to save seeds and preserve the harvest, everything. But it also tells the story of Soulfire Farm. And it also tells the story, which I started to get into earlier, of examples of Black and African contributions to sustainable agriculture historically, which I think is very, very important for us to understand that there is a legacy that we're building on. It's not something that's starting today.
Excellent. Oh, so much information. I know people are going to be running to their nearest library, if not bookstore. downloading it, you know, there's other big box downloaders. I'm not going to give names, but one of the things I like to do with on Race Talks is to talk. So let's talk terms, shall we?
Okay, let's do it.
I just want to make sure for those of you who want more of Leah, is it Leah or Leah? Am I saying it correctly?
Either one is fine. So Leah is the anglicized version that people mostly use, but it does come from the biblical Leah. Okay. So I respond to either. We'll go with that. Well, like Star Wars or the Bible, whatever floats your boat. Right.
I'm going to stop there because I want to mention that you and Leah have a similar experience. You talked about being on the farm and when you were young and how it was a lot of work, but you were doing it. And so she mentioned the same thing that, you know, she was involved with the land. And again, I'm a little bit out of order. The terms I'm sure are coming up, but armed with that kind of experience, she then talked about here having to be in a structural place with white males and how uncomfortable that was, where she was even questioning whether she should be in that space. Mm-hmm. And that's what you were talking about, I believe, when you were referring to the stress and just doing something that should come normal in life.
Yeah, absolutely. And you remember from again, the training that you attended when I talked about stereotype threat, right? And the book Whistling Vivaldi by Dr. Steele. And that, you know, the studies that he and his team did on what happens when you enter into a space where you don't see yourself, right? Mm-hmm. Where you don't feel as if you're not only you're not welcome, but you just don't see yourself there. And so you can't see your potential. You begin to question why you are there. Do you really belong there? And this can happen in the space of racial stereotype. It can also happen in the gender realm and almost any level of identity, which goes back to what we started talking about at the beginning of the show, right? This whole notion of identity and where the first harm can occur, according to the healing-centered engagement work, is in the area of who we are, our identity. And so, yes, when you walk into spaces and places like most of us have for most of our lives, where the institution or the organization or the system is run by, you know, people who do not look like you, in the realm of skin color or race, which, you know, is kind of interchangeable, it's not the same thing, we know that. If you're not careful and you're not rooted, you begin to wonder whether that's where you belong and your performance goes down. And so if you step out of the racial realm and you get into the gender realm and you tell, you know, college students who are, you know, identify as women or female, listen, we're so glad that you're here in this school and we want you to represent women well, and you lift up the identity of being woman. And then you say, now, well, I want you to go take this standardized test. They don't do as well as those who are not triggered by the gender piece. And so this can happen in lots of different ways. And in our conversation today about racial healing, we need to really acknowledge what stereotype can do to confound not only our cognitive processing of information so we don't perform well, but it also plays into our ability to see ourselves fitting in. And over time, we don't perform as well. We end up you know, in other places than we want to be. So if you go to a four-year institution after graduating high school and doing well, you might end up, you know, stop going to that institution and end up not only at community college, but out of the educational realm entirely, all because you didn't see yourself represented in the space where you were.
And I had that understanding with my students. I was the director of Multicultural Student Affairs at Skidmore College, mm-hmm. and they actually, instead of busing students up, they had Amtrak them up, I called it, because they brought them from New York City. And then they got to this space and they didn't feel like they belonged because the majority of students there had no need for any kind of financial sustenance from the government. Mm-hmm. Their parents were paying 96% of the students didn't receive any financial aid whatsoever, not $1. Mm-hmm. So you had these students coming into a space where they only like knew their neighborhood in New York City, into a space where people had horses on campus. You know, right. They had brought their horses from their farms. And so they didn't feel like they belonged. And many times this is the time that they would probably first semester leave. But that's kind of what my office, Multicultural Student Affairs Office, was designed to do, to try to make them feel they belong. Then one of my statements to them to just try to flip the script in the way they thought was, but their parents pay for them to come, mm-hmm. and they pay you to come. So mm-hmm. are you not important to this experience, to this place? Mm-hmm. And they went, oh, okay, let's see a little bit differently. So yeah, it does play on someone's mind, because you can enter the space, but that could just make you feel even more uncomfortable once you get there, if there is no one who shares a similar background, heritage, or physical identity.
Right. And what we've been encouraged to do, trained to do, socialized to do, is work harder, right? Mm-hmm. So study harder, study more, you can do it, get back to the library, all of which is further confounding our ability to cognitively process, because it's making us feel more and more estranged and less of a feeling of belonging, right? And so the recommended strategy is find like-minded students who become your friends, your study group, your social group, and then you move together through this process. And so I think what that allows us to do is begin to feel a sense of belonging within the context of this sometimes pretty unusual and foreign experience for us. And my own upbringing was in a very diverse block in the city of Mount Vernon. And yet when I went away to school, I was still unprepared for what I walked into in that institution, which was not only, you know, an overwhelming imbalance of students of color and white students, but then the first movie they played on campus for the community was The Birth of a Nation. And so now I'm feeling unsafe. In the midst of my identity, I'm now feeling unsafe. And that was the beginning of my college experience. And then I left, you know.
Okay. I wanted to add to those who are listening who might not know what Birth of a Nation is, but that was one of the first moving pictures, right? So it was a big boon to the area of the film industry. And so, but it was racist. It showed white people in blackface being mm-hmm. dumb, being ignorant, being deviant, and just every stereotype that was negative of the time. And it was played at the White House for the president. Right. So that was the largest system you can ever, you know, seek to imagine, where it was racist fervor, actually. Right. And the Ku Klux Klan was in support of it. And so one would think then our government was filled with members of the Ku Klux Klan, which was not, you know, surprising, but to be so out there, right? So very overt in displaying that. So yes, we've come a long way, but we still have some ways to go. And I just want to finally get to the top. I'm sure we're going to get to terms, but I like the segue that you brought in, because we do talk about gender identity and other types of terms for, you know, Black people and other identities. So let's try to listen to that. I'm sure it's coming up. And I share with people, you know, terms are as good as how we communicate with them, right? And people who share BIPOC is confusing, Black, Indigenous, people of color. I think in on your website you have Afro-Indigenous there, which may or may not be BIPOC. You can share with me about that. I really like the fact that Latinx, I think I haven't seen this before, but in the writings, Latinxs, so I guess that's a group of Latinx. Is that also gender identity along with Latin, along with ethnicity? What are your thoughts on terms that we've used?
Terms.
What is black and brown? What are these ethnic identities, in your opinion, how you use them?
Oh, I love that you bring this up. And I think the reason that we actually change it up a lot is because we want to complicate the idea that you can have a term, in other words, a box that includes everyone really neatly. And you can't, right? Because you're talking about, when you say BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, People of Color, you're talking about everybody in the world who doesn't identify as white. That is a highly diverse group of people that may have no common shared experience. And so when we, you know, we talk about this in our programs, we break it down with a whole lot of asterisks and footnotes, that this is really an imperfect term. The reason that people put the BI in front is to center the communities upon whose oppression this nation was built. So Black communities, the labor of the Black community, and the lands, you know, again, oversimplifying, of the Indigenous people, those were the original oppressions upon which this country was built, so that those get centered in the narrative. Afro-Indigenous is a little bit different. Afro-Indigenous we use to refer specifically to the culture and practices of Black people pre-colonization and decolonized. So when we talk about the way that Yoruba people historically did soil testing with their hands, that is a pre-colonial Indigenous practice of the Yoruba people who are Black, right? And who are our ancestors and from the continent of Africa. And so a lot of what we're trying to do, you know, at Soulfire Farm is to try to understand these Afro-Indigenous, Black Indigenous practices. What were the Mende and the Wolof rice farmers doing? What are the Yoruba people doing? What are the Krobo people of Ghana doing with their shared lands tenure? How can we build our land trust like that? So we're trying to understand these practices that are not as impacted by European mindset as a way of reclaiming our own indigeneity, if that makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, that makes a lot of sense to me. What does it make for you, Mr. Owens? Putting you on the spot a little bit.
Oh, yeah. I understand and appreciate and resonate with everything that Leah said, and I think it does make a lot of sense. I think what it also allows us to see is the challenge of trying to put a name to who you are and what that name really translates into in terms of, you know, meaning, purpose, identity, and ultimately what we're talking about, you know, this evening, healing, right? And so, you know, when we you know, have a group of people who over the course of time find themselves renaming themselves, I think it is a manifestation of, you know, growing, understanding more, you know, making more connections to people outside of those who named you, you know, throwing off the impression of that, and then beginning to network with your history, if you will. And so, you know, once upon a time, people were very disturbed when people started, you know, using African names. And you know, some folks said, no, you can't call yourself that.
Yes.
Until you began to understand better what that whole process was about. And I don't think we fully understand it today yet. But I think what we're trying to do is one of the karma principles in the healing process that Dr. Jinright talks about, and that's meaning. We're trying to find meaning. And the other principle that he talks about is agency. What do I own? What is it that I have control over? And if I'm going to heal, I got to find what I have control over in the midst of the chaos I live in the midst of the persistent traumatic stress that I'm undergoing. And naming myself is a way to do that. And so it's important that we find the best place to do this process. Now, you know, I've seen iterations of people who identify as Latino and Hispanic, and there are people generationally who say, I'm not calling myself Latinx. As a matter of fact, you know, if you call me that, I'm not going to be part of this conversation. Exactly. And then I've heard more recently the term Latine, which right. I, you know, it's another iteration of that. So it is further developing, I think, people's consciousness about who they would like to be called, because this is who I see myself as, right? So identity is multifaceted. It is certainly multi-leveled. And I think that we're going to see people who are in the process of healing claiming and reclaiming their relationship to themselves, their history, their families, and in this context this evening, relationship to the land. So I like where Leah has gone with this, and I think it plays nicely into this whole notion of racial healing.
Yes, and I think there's power into giving yourself a name. You know, I was just in the school system, and there are students who tell me what they want to be called. Mm-hmm. And they're young, and they're already understanding the burden of being called something that doesn't quite make them feel comfortable, mm-hmm. that makes them feel, in every sense, who they are or what they're capable of becoming. Mm-hmm. And that's why when students tell me what to call them, I try to call them whatever name they want, because that is that sense of ownership for their name allows them to do better in school, to hear me when I speak to them. And that's part of, you know, progressing, having them be in a place where they can be a listener and be more desirous of acting in a way that allows them to be a better student or a better person. Mm-hmm. So when people mm-hmm. say, why do you call them that? I'm like, because they asked me to. Mm-hmm. There's really no harm in that. That's kind of like a way to repair relations, I think, within the African-American community, just listening. Because mm-hmm. I've had friends who've said, why is it African-American? Why don't you just call yourself American? Because we aren't just Americans, and we were always told of such. And by us being able to give ourselves a name out of colored or Negro or even just Black, you know, mm-hmm. it's definitely something that's powerful. I think almost every generation might do something like that. So when we get terms like BIPOC or Afro-Indigenous, it's another sign of an age of people mm-hmm. dealing with systemic racism over time and how to heal from that, how to overcome that aggression.
Mm-hmm. And I think what we also have to do is be careful about accepting names that are not helpful to us, but are harmful to us, and being able to engage in the process of teaching people why that is harmful to you. And so I've tried to work with institutions around the whole notion of racial justice, and well, you know my background. So I've come up against systems where someone might say, well, what if we want to, you know, allow students to call themselves X? Or, you know, don't you know that Y is a more, you know, current term? And I say, well, but that's not a self-affirming, healthy term. It comes out of a very bad place. And so this whole notion of claiming it for yourself and turning it around, if you claim something that's unhealthy, then now it's unhealthy for you. And so I think it's important for us to help, you know, people understand that it's not always the best thing to adopt something that's unhealthy and use that as your name and clothe yourself in that and bathe yourself in that every day, because other people don't allow themselves to be called pejorative things. And so they will not be harmed by that. As a matter of fact, they draw the line there. I've had workshops where people come to me afterwards and say, you know why people don't call us this anymore? Because we won't allow it. And so I wish that we would learn from that in terms of embracing what our aspirational future would be around who we want to be called and how we want to identify.
I think if anyone just learns that from tonight, that would be excellent, because, you know, words can hurt and they can heal. So mm-hmm. being called the right word is healing for sure. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to allow Leah to end with sharing how people can contact her. And then I'm going to give you that opportunity as we come to an end. And then we're going to play some music to celebrate the culture that we are of Hispanic or Latino heritage for the month, half of the month. All right, let's say goodbye to Leah.
I have another book coming out, Black Earth Wisdom, next year. and it is Soulful Conversations with Notable Black Environmentalists. So some of the big names of our day, folks like Alice Walker, Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, Josh Bennett, Toshi Regan. I'm in conversation with them and contextualizing what they're saying in terms of the major environmental issues of today and what the earth is trying to tell us. So anyway, I was thinking we should do a book release in Hudson.
You should.
Let's talk about that.
Places.
Okay, let's talk about that because I would love to collaborate and
Just get them folks from the Hudson Area Library. I might have to have you stop by there too.
Okay. Good for you.
I'm so loving this. Thank you so much for being on Race Talks. I know there's like thousands of things we could have talked about, but like I said, this particular media environment is always open to everyone in your organization. I'm going to get my butt up there. Maybe I can do something live with me actually working on the farm.
Oh, that'd be fun. Yeah, we have our community volunteer days every other week. So if you want to come and get some ambient sound and get your hands dirty, you're more than welcome.
Oh, yeah. Well, then I'm up there. I'm going to look on the website. So share with us, how do I get the information about what you just mentioned? I know there's a website, but
absolutely. So we try to make sure everything's on our website. So it's a one-stop shop. So if you go to soulfirefarm.org, that's all one word, soulfirefarm.org, or follow us on the Instas and the Facebook, again, Soulfire Farm, all lowercase, all one word. And you can sign up for every month. We have a tour. Two times a month, we have a volunteer day. We have online farmer training classes. And then in the spring, we build gardens for free for people who are survivors of food apartheid in Albany and Troy. We have free food deliveries. Those sign-ups during the spring. And then we have a lot of on-farm courses and youth programs. So check out our website and like sign up and come hang out with us. Yeah.
If I'm white and male, am I invited?
Yeah. So our tours and our volunteer days are open to the public. And if there's any specific population we're targeting, for example, the food deliveries are just for low income families, it will say that. So you'll be very clear if that program is open to the public or if it's a specific group that we're targeting with the program.
Because I think everyone needs to eat off the land. So,
Absolutely. Come on out. We'd love to have your help and we'd love to meet you.
Excellent. Well, this is it for Race Talks with Leah Penniman of Soulfire Farm.
Bye. Thanks for having me.
Now it's your turn, Gregory. Now I want everyone to know that you are welcome back every month if you'd like.
Thank you.
So what can we see in the future from you?
Well, I'm continuing to do work in different places around the country around organizational transformation and racial equity. And so we're working with big systems, both at the state level and county level in a couple of places. And I'm doing work with a friend of mine out of St. Louis and other people who have a long history of doing this work. If you want to reach out to me, you can reach out to me at Macedonia Baptist Church. Website is macedoniaofalbany, all one word, .org, macedoniaofalbany.org. And just, you know, hit the contact button and someone will get to me with whatever question you might have. We are a church that does a lot of interesting action-oriented activist kinds of work. We have a food pantry, we have food drives. We are in the midst right now of implementing a suicide prevention program for young people, specifically focusing on the rising rates of suicide for young African-American males. We're training young people to be peer support, and we're training adults to support those young people. But this is a church that talks about, you know, how important it is to have mind, body, and spirit aligned to do the work that we're supposed to do. So I'm looking forward to seeing what you do. This is a wonderful program. And as I said to you when I met you, if I can be of any assistance or help, I will. I won't commit to coming back every month, but we'll talk. All right. But
it's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much. Well, we have iCamp coming up. So we're going to share everyone with that in the future. But right now, I want to thank my listeners, as I promised. Here is Celia Cruz. We're going to end with her today, and we're going to start with her next month on Race Talks when we talk to more people about